Mind and Body Reset, Modern Wellness Decoded. Science-backed wellness made simple.
You know, there's something so primal about our connection to water, isn't there? That feeling of a hot shower after a long day, or the shock of a cold plunge in the ocean.
Oh, absolutely. It's this universal experience. For me, it's always been swimming. Just the feeling of being weightless and suspended. It's my go-to for clearing my head. It's a mental reset as much as a physical one.
That's exactly it. And that feeling is what got me really curious about today's topic. I've been reading a lot about the intentional use of water for health, not just for hygiene or recreation, but as a therapeutic tool. It made me start to question, what is it about water that feels so restorative?
Yeah, and it's not a new idea, is it? I mean, you think of ancient civilizations, the Roman baths, Japanese onsen. They weren't just about getting clean. There was something deeper going on, a ritual.
A ritual and a science. And that's precisely what we're going to explore today. We're talking about hydrotherapy, using water as a wellness ally.
I'm so glad we're covering this. I think a lot of people hear hydrotherapy and maybe think of something very clinical, or maybe just a fancy spa treatment. But the applications are so much broader.
They really are. We're going to dive into the physiological effects. What's actually happening in our bodies when we immerse ourselves in hot or cold water. We'll look at the history, but also the cutting-edge science.
And the practical side too, right? How people can actually use these principles at home without needing access to a high-end facility.
Exactly. So, the big question we're setting out to answer today is this. In our complex modern world, could one of the most powerful tools for our physical and mental well-being be the simplest, most fundamental element on Earth?
It's a fascinating question. I have a feeling the answer is a lot more complex and exciting than most of us realize.
And I think that complexity is the perfect place to start. Because when you look back, this isn't some gentle woo-woo wellness trend. The modern hydrotherapy movement, especially in the 19th century, was, well, it was kind of radical.
Radical how? You mean in contrast to the medicine of the time?
Precisely. You have to picture it. The 1800s. Medicine was often brutal. We're talking bloodletting, mercury, harsh purgatives. And then along comes this farmer from Silesia, a man named Vincent Preissnitz.
A farmer? Not a doctor?
Not at all. And that's the fascinating part. He wasn't trained in medicine. He just observed animals healing their injuries in cold streams and started experimenting on himself and then on his neighbors. He developed this whole system based on cold water, fresh air, and simple food.
So what did his water cure actually involve? I'm picturing something a bit more intense than a relaxing bath.
Oh, much more intense. We're talking about wrapping patients in cold, wet sheets, the wet sheet pack, making them drink enormous quantities of cold water, and taking long, strenuous hikes before plunging into icy baths.
Wow. Okay, that sounds severe. It's hard to imagine people willingly signing up for that, especially the well-to-do.
But they did. In droves. His establishment at Grafenberg became a sensation. And this idea, it just exploded across Europe. It landed in Britain with figures like James Wilson and James Manby Gully, who set up a now famous water cure establishment in Malvern.
Malvern. I know that name. It became a huge hub for this, didn't it?
A massive hub. And they weren't just treating farmers. We're talking about the intellectual and cultural elite of the Victorian era. Charles Darwin went there for his chronic illnesses.
Darwin? No way.
Yes. And Charles Dickens, Florence Nightingale, Lord Tennyson, the list is staggering. They were all seeking an alternative to the often ineffective, sometimes deadly, orthodox medicine of the day.
So this wasn't just a fringe movement. It was a genuine challenge to the medical establishment. I can't imagine that went over well.
Not in the slightest. There was huge antagonism. You had figures like Sir Charles Hastings, who ironically founded the British Medical Association, publicly condemning hydropathy and Gully in particular. It was a full-on war of words and philosophies.
Which, in a way, just proves how threatening they found it. You don't launch that kind of attack on an idea you think is just going to fade away.
And you have to wonder, what was it about the idea that was so powerful? I mean, beyond just being an alternative, was it the simplicity, the return to nature? Or was it that the whole system, the cold water, the hikes, the diet, was a kind of structured ordeal, a challenge you could overcome, which must have felt incredibly empowering compared to just passively taking a pill prescribed by some distant doctor?
That's a really sharp point. It's about agency, isn't it? In the 1800s, if you were ill, you were largely a passive recipient of, well, of whatever treatment, however harsh, a doctor decided on. But at a place like Malvern, you were an active participant. You were the one drinking the water, taking the plunge, doing the hike. It reframed the entire relationship with your own health.
So the therapy wasn't just the water itself, but the regimen, the discipline. It gave people a sense of control in an era where so much, especially when it came to health, felt completely out of their hands.
Right. And let's be honest, getting people out of polluted, cramped Victorian cities, away from their stressful lives, and putting them in the fresh air of the Malvern Hills with simple food, that alone would have had a profound effect, surely.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's the big question from a modern scientific perspective, isn't it? How do you disentangle the specific effects of the cold water from the confounding variables? The diet, the exercise, the community, the placebo effect of being in this famous, expensive place with all these famous people.
But does it matter if the package worked? I get what you're saying from a clinical trial standpoint, but for the person, for Darwin, trying to manage his debilitating symptoms, the why is less important than the that.
No, you're right. From a patient perspective, it doesn't matter at all. But it's fascinating to try and reverse engineer it. Because what they were doing, without the scientific language for it, was essentially a massive nervous system reset. They were inducing a state of hormesis, a beneficial stress.
Hormesis. That's the idea that a little bit of a bad thing can actually be good for you, right? Like exercise is a stressor, but it makes you stronger.
Precisely. That shock of the cold water, that strenuous hike, it's a short, intense stressor that forces the body to adapt and become more resilient. They didn't know about vasoconstriction or norepinephrine release, but they saw the results. People felt more alive, more energetic. They felt better.
And there's another layer to this that I think is crucial, especially when you mention Florence Nightingale. Think about the women of that era. Their illnesses were so often dismissed as, you know, hysteria, nerves. It wasn't taken seriously by the male-dominated medical establishment.
That is such a critical point. So these water cure establishments, they were offering a space where female suffering was validated.
I think so. It was a place where their symptoms were seen as real, and they were given a tangible physical protocol to address them. It wasn't just, there, dear, it's all in your head. It was, here is a demanding regimen. Your body is strong. You can do this. That is a profoundly different message.
Wow. I hadn't fully considered it through that lens. It wasn't just a medical movement. It was, in a way, a social one. It offered an escape route from a kind of medical paternalism.
It really was. It gave people, and especially women, a set of tools and a philosophy they could use to reclaim authority over their own bodies. And that, I think, is a huge part of why it wasn't just a fad, but a genuine threat to the old guard. It wasn't just selling water, it was selling self-reliance.
And that concept of self-reliance, it's so much bigger than just health, isn't it? It taps into that whole 19th century zeitgeist, this idea of conquering nature, of conquering the self through discipline. It's almost heroic. They weren't just patients. They were adventurers on a journey to reclaim their own vitality.
Right. It's a completely different narrative. Instead of, I am sick and a doctor will fix me, it becomes my body is out of balance and I will undertake this challenge to restore it. The power dynamic is just completely inverted.
Completely. But that brings us back to that tricky question you touched on earlier. If the narrative is that powerful, how much of the benefit was just the narrative? How much was a kind of mass placebo effect, driven by being in this beautiful place, surrounded by famous people, all believing in the same thing?
Yeah, the ultimate wellness retreat, basically. And it's impossible to ignore that factor. But I find myself pushing back against the word just. To say something is just a placebo feels so dismissive. The placebo effect is a real, measurable, biological event. It proves the mind has a profound ability to influence the body. Maybe they weren't curing the root disease, but they were absolutely triggering the body's own healing mechanisms.
Okay, that's a much better way to frame it. They were masters of leveraging the placebo response, even if they didn't call it that. They were creating the perfect conditions, the hope, the ritual, the active participation, for the mind to tell the body, hey, it's time to get to work.
And now, we can actually look at the specific physiology they were stumbling upon. You mentioned hormesis, that beneficial stress. Let's get into the weeds with that. What is actually happening when someone in the 1850s is forced into an icy bath?
Okay, so, picture it. The shock hits. The first thing that happens is a massive, involuntary gasp for air. Then, your surface blood vessels, the capillaries in your skin, slam shut. That's vasoconstriction. The body is trying to protect its core, pulling all the blood inward to keep your vital organs warm.
A survival instinct, basically.
A pure survival instinct. But in that moment of perceived crisis, the brain also hits a big red panic button. It floods your system with catecholamines, specifically norepinephrine and dopamine. Norepinephrine is all about focus, alertness, and mood. It's a powerful anti-inflammatory. It's why after that initial shock, people often report this incredible feeling of clarity and euphoria.
So that feeling of being intensely alive after a cold plunge, that's not just relief that it's over. That's a genuine chemical cocktail hitting your brain?
It is a profound neurochemical event. They were, without knowing it, giving themselves a massive dose of a powerful neurotransmitter that regulates attention and mood. And they were doing it every single day. Over time, that doesn't just make you feel good in the moment, it can fundamentally change your baseline resilience to stress.
It's fascinating because it's so counterintuitive. You're putting your body into a state of alarm to make it calmer in the long run.
You're teaching it the difference between a real threat and a perceived one. You're training your nervous system to recover from stress more efficiently. It's like a workout for your entire regulatory system.
And when you think about someone like Darwin, suffering from what many now believe was a severe anxiety or panic disorder, this daily structured encounter with a manageable acute stressor, it suddenly makes so much sense why that might have been more effective for him than anything else available at the time.
It gave him a sense of mastery over his own physiological reactions. He could feel his heart pound, his breathing quicken, and then he could feel it all calm down again. He was practicing the art of self-regulation with water as his tool.
So these early pioneers, like Preissnitz, were more like intuitive physiologists than anything else. They were observing cause and effect without having the vocabulary to explain the mechanism. Which makes you wonder, who took these fairly extreme, radical ideas and started to refine them into something more systematic?
That is the perfect question, because the person who really answers it is a Bavarian priest named Sebastian Kneipp. He comes along a little later in the 19th century, and he takes Preissnitz's, let's call it brute force approach, and refines it into a genuine philosophy.
A priest? Okay, that's a different angle. So he's bringing a spiritual element into it?
A huge one. He himself was cured of tuberculosis, he believed, by short dips in the freezing Danube River. But his system wasn't just about the shock of the cold. He built what he called his five pillars.
Five pillars. Okay, I'm listening.
Water was the first, of course. But then he added plants, herbal medicine, then exercise, then nutrition, simple whole foods. And the fifth, and maybe the most important, was balance. He called it Ordnungstherapie, therapy through order. A balanced, orderly life. Mind and body working together.
Wow. Okay. So he's basically inventing the modern concept of a holistic wellness lifestyle. He's connecting all the dots. It's not just about dunking yourself in cold water anymore. It's about how you live your entire life.
That's the leap he made. He made it accessible. He made it a system. And that, I think, is where the real power lies and what has carried through to today. It's this idea that these simple ancient elements, water, movement, food, mindfulness, they aren't separate things. They're all part of the same conversation our body is having with itself.
It's incredible to trace that thread, isn't it? From a primal feeling, to a radical Victorian rebellion, to a priest's holistic philosophy. And now to us, with our smartwatches and our stress trackers, rediscovering that a cold shower might do more for our nervous system than an hour of scrolling.
And we have the science to explain why it works now. We can talk about norepinephrine and vasoconstriction, but the fundamental truth of it, they knew. They felt it. They just had a different language for it.
So when you step back from it all, what's the one thing that really sticks with you from this whole journey?
For me, I think it has to be the concept of hormesis. That idea that we've become so obsessed with comfort, we've forgotten that our bodies are designed for and actually thrive on small, manageable doses of stress. That we can train our resilience. The science behind that is just, it's so elegant.
That's fascinating. See, for me, it's something slightly different. It's the idea of agency. The story that keeps replaying in my mind is that of the Victorian women being told their suffering was hysteria and finding in this water cure a way to take back control. A tangible, difficult, but empowering path. It reminds me that wellness isn't just about biology. It's about narrative. It's about the story we tell ourselves about our own strength.
That's a beautiful way to put it. The story we tell ourselves. And maybe the ultimate takeaway isn't that everyone needs to go jump in an icy lake tomorrow.
Probably for the best. Yes. A few people might be relieved to hear that.
But maybe it's just an invitation to be more intentional. To notice the feeling of warm water on your hands when you wash them. To take that extra 30 seconds in a cold shower. To simply acknowledge this profound, ancient relationship we have with the most fundamental element on Earth.
A simple acknowledgement. I like that. It feels like a perfect place to end. Thank you, as always, for diving into this with me.
It was a pleasure. And to everyone listening, thank you for joining us on this exploration. We hope it gives you a new perspective next time you turn on the tap.
Until next time, stay curious.